This episode is sponsored by Code Health. Code connects healthcare providers to the largest community of medical coding professionals in the country, with over 4,600 domestic certified coders. As a single stop for all coding needs, Code's on-demand model has solved for daily staffing challenges and coding inefficiencies by allowing providers to access the right coder at the right time while gaining insights to better manage their coding operations. To learn more about Code, visit codehealth.com, that's K-O-D-E-health.com, or email Code directly at partnerships@codehealth.com. Supporting women in the workplace, today on HFMA's Voices in Healthcare Finance podcast. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Erica Grotto. Today we're discussing the effects perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause have on women in the workplace, and how leaders can better support all employees with physical and mental symptoms that affect their daily work. But first, let's find out what's happening in healthcare finance news. Here's HFMA Senior Editor Nick Hutt and HFMA Policy Director Sean Stack.
Hello, everybody. We wanted to talk about several key federal regulatory updates. But first of all, Sean, are there any noteworthy updates on the Change Healthcare situation? I know there was a recent call of the HFMA provider work group that's been meeting at regular intervals since this whole thing started.
Yeah, we met last Friday. We are set to meet again this Friday to follow up on some issues. I have reached out to Change Healthcare several times in the last couple of weeks and have not received answers to my questions on some of the really administratively burdensome and lingering issues that are coming out of the Change Healthcare outage, which I guess we expected to happen. We just expected Change to be a little bit more forthcoming and sharing hopefully some solutions that can help providers post and receive some of their payments that they've been due, I guess, for a couple of months now. Hospitals and providers are still very much so struggling to get those historical 835s downloaded from Change and their network. And they're being told, or they're having to go out directly to the payer portals that they can access, some of them they can't access, to obtain those 835s and manually post those to their patient accounting systems. Also, we're hearing from providers that the duplicate, as I feared, and if you remember, Nick, this is something that I said from the very beginning, we are probably in store for a very heavy 6 months to 12 months of duplicative denials due to the fallout and the outage. And I'm hearing from a lot of our providers that they are starting to see those duplicate denials coming through, and they're having to navigate massive volumes of denials on claims that is just going to be a huge administrative burden. So more to come, and we'll be following up in detail with Change and their team to try to get answers to these questions. But yeah, it's still lingering quite a bit.
Yeah, you've been sounding that alarm for a while now, and it just remains to be seen what the long-term revenue cycle impact is going to be. One thing to keep an eye on, and this will have happened by the time this episode airs, is that the CEO of United Health Group, Andrew Witty, is scheduled to testify at separate Senate and House hearings in the same day. So we'll be able to discuss any relevant news or key takeaways in our next episode. I know the American Hospital Association submitted comments to Congress in advance of those hearings, just sharing the hospital view. So definitely something to watch for. So moving on to our regulatory discussion, several of these new rules that have come out in recent weeks involve Medicaid. CMS has published final rules on eligibility and enrollment, on access in the Medicaid program, and quality, finance, access, just a whole bunch of different stuff in Medicaid managed care specifically. So those are the three rules. Sean, as we think about, you know, our audience, the HFMA audience, if they were to try to sift through all those rules combined, I think it would be almost 2,500, 3,000 pages in the pre-published draft form. But what are some key nuggets to be aware of in terms of how these rules potentially shape the program going forward?
Yeah, I think what a lot of hospitals are looking right now at and sifting through this rule, you know, the rule does do a great deal to streamline enrollment application, reduce coverage disruptions in Medicaid rulemaking. It doesn't really finalize problematic policies to cap state-directed payments. It codifies average commercial rate as a limit. It requires attestation that hospitals do not participate in impermissible or harmless arrangements. That enforcement begins January 1st, I think, of 2028. It requires plans to include SDP dollars in MLR and capitated rates. It eliminates prior approval for certain SDPs. Of course, it requires those SDPs linked to utilization within applicable rating periods. Just on a side note, you know, Medicaid coverage, we're still continuing to see disenrollment. You know, there's 20 million plus disenrolled so far through those continuing concerns around medical renewals. We're seeing about 23% that are disenrolled are now uninsured. We're starting to see those numbers come in. 28% have enrolled in another form of coverage. In many cases, those high deductible plans, because we're seeing a pretty large, I think the exchange network has had the largest enrollment numbers that they've ever seen this last year. So we're seeing, you know, that means that a lot of folks are going into those high deductible plans, which is posing a higher coinsurance for more patients across the healthcare continuum, which is an issue for hospitals. So we're seeing a lot there. We're seeing policies in place to mitigate coverage loss for people who are Medicaid eligible, state option to extend postpartum coverage, 12 months of continuous coverage for children. Great thing there. And then just robust market enrollment growth. So those are the things that I'm taking out of the latest policy. Anything that you noticed, Nick, that stood out to you?
Well, I think you make a great point. None of these rules really directly addressed the Medicaid unwinding that's been going on for more than a year now. But certainly that's sort of the subtext, just in terms of trying to account for the many millions who've been disenrolled from the program. And according to Kaiser Family Foundation, who's been doing a really good job tracking the numbers since April of 2023, as of the third week in April, more than 29 million people, their eligibility still needed to be determined. So these numbers could spike quite a bit more in the upcoming months. As I think about providers, and this may not affect too many people because a lot of them are already doing this, but the rule on Medicaid access, again, I mentioned at the outset, there's three separate rules that have been published. The one on Medicaid access requires state plans to ensure that 80% of payments that they're directing toward home and community-based services, it's basically establishing a medical loss ratio of 80%, ensuring that 80% of payments go toward direct care workers rather than to, you know, administrative overhead or profit or anything like that. So plans are going to have to be accounting for how they funnel their funds. And that's something that could affect providers as they provide those services going forward.
You know, that'll be yet to be seen and see what that impact is. And does that mean that if the plans have to focus more of those dollars on actually delivering healthcare services rather than in the prior auth process or the utilization management process, I guess that is kind of providing services. But will that reflect on the and hopefully decrease the administrative burden dollars that hospitals are pumping into healthcare to just get paid, right?
Yeah, great point. One other topic we wanted to touch on real quick, 340B, there has been from the Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA, a new rule changing the administrative dispute resolution process that was first implemented back in 2021 with a 2020 rule that was issued at the end of the Trump administration. Just recently, some of those regulations have been changed. Sean, what did you make of this development?
Well, I mean, so far I'm optimistic about this rule. We'll see how it rolls out and how it's implemented. But, you know, this new rule makes the ADR process hopefully more accessible to all 340B hospitals. It establishes an administrative process that is less formal and trial-like. The review is limited to claims where drug companies have overcharged the covered entity for a 340B drug. And by overcharges, we mean those overcharges will include claims where drug companies have denied or limited access to 340B pricing, which could include contract pharmacy claims. And then lastly, it kind of allows 340B covered entities to bring forth claims regardless of the dollar amount of the claim at issue. So it could help show trends in unfavorable activity that 340B entities are struggling with. So far, I think this rule looks like it could be very good for providers.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. And thanks, Sean, for the insight.
Thank you, Ned.
We'll be back in a moment.
This is Sean Stack, HFMA's Director of Perspectives and Analysis, and I'm excited to tell you about our new bi-monthly webinar series designed specifically for hospital executives. HFMA will provide timely updates on the latest national healthcare reimbursement and revenue cycle regulations, policies, and trends. This series will equip you with the knowledge and insights you need to navigate the complex world of your healthcare business office. You can register now at hfma.org under webinars.
Menopause and the phases that come before and after are comedy gold in some circles. But hot flashes, mood swings, and heart palpitations are no laughing matter for the women who experience them, especially if they're happening in the middle of a busy workday. And just like many of the funny videos I found on Instagram about the topic, menopause discussion is often not safe for work. But according to my guest today, that shouldn't deter leaders from creating a culture that's supportive of women who might be experiencing symptoms. Dr. Bruce Doerr is a board-certified urogynecology and pelvic surgeon and senior medical advisor for BioT. He recently chatted with me about how the workplace can be more accommodating.
Everybody is built differently, and everybody's nutrition, exercise, genetics that they have is all varied on the symptoms that they experience and how much that affects them as they go through and they experience this hormone loss. When you look at how severe this can be, BioT conducted a survey in January of 2022 of 1,000 women. And 17% of those women said that they quit or would quit their job because their symptoms were so significant. The stigma that surrounds menopause and those symptoms, because not everybody is that severe, but it's that severe to that patient or that person. And so to understand the variation in how bad this can be for some people to quit their job over, that has to start with an open dialogue of people in the workplace to not stigmatize women for having these symptoms that are a normal part for them and for their lives. And so to have an HR person or somebody who can understand, okay, yeah, I didn't experience that, but I understand this is really significant for you. Let's find a way to get you in a better atmosphere or a better work environment, or get you to somebody who can be better as far as therapy goes so that we can work through this and we don't lose a valuable employee like yourself.
So I'm hearing this with the ears of some listeners, and I feel like there are women out there who are saying, there is no way I would ever talk about any health issue at work. And
exactly.
some health issues or some workplaces are fine and safe places to do that.
Yeah.
Not every workplace really is. So what do you think employers should know that will help people that won't necessarily require disclosure of age and health issues? Because age plays a factor here too, especially for women in the workplace. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that yes, there are many people who would be hesitant in bringing this up. You know, could you do any kind of work or health survey as people are coming in? How can we provide the best schedule? How can we provide the best work environment for you specifically? You know, some people, they get, you know, more of their symptoms in the afternoon. You know, is it possible for me to do more of this in the morning? Can I be in an environment where I have better access and I'm not criticized for needing more frequent restroom trips or, controlling my temperature in my environment? It's just going to foster better loyalty and reputation of that company to have a good HR team to provide that flexibility, whether or not it's their environment or whether or not that's their work schedule, is to work around that so that they can get relief in those different areas, because it is going to be different for every patient, unfortunately, is to deal that way too. Hopefully that makes sense.
Absolutely. And I'm thinking some of this, it doesn't have to be HR, right? It can just be your direct manager being able to discuss. And a lot of what you're talking about feels like workplace culture to me.
It is.
Some of it can be from a policy standpoint, as far as flexible hours and things like that. But culture, I think, comes in a lot. And what I'm also hearing is that some of these strategies would work for anybody.
Right.
It doesn't have to be a woman going through this period of her life. It could be a pregnant woman. Again, I've got three children, so right. I went through three pregnancies while employed, and boy, oh boy, yeah. There are good days and bad days there.
Well, and you see, Erica, too, that, you know, some people get it, and it's not just a male female thing. Some people, you know, get it as far as, yeah, I understand this was a bad day. You may have been up all night that you didn't get good sleep or things like that going on, whether or not it's pregnancy, whether or not it is menopause associated.
It could be ambulance sirens on your street that kept you
exactly.
up all night, right? But, right. you know, it doesn't right. even have to be a health issue. It just can be something that you can say, I need a little understanding today.
Right. Yeah. So it is about that understanding and flexibility in a work environment. And I think, we're hopefully becoming a more kinder, gentler culture when we look at that. But yeah, many employers are like, yeah, if you don't come in today, yeah, you're fired. You know, I think that to have that open dialogue and conversation is really the key to all this, no matter what the symptomatology is. But unfortunately, it hits women harder, whether or not that is based on body changes that happen during pregnancy, whether or not that is body changes that happen during menopause.
What would your advice be to women in perimenopause, or maybe just in some other kind of time of life when they're experiencing health issues that don't preclude them from working, right? But do affect right. them at work. What's your number one piece of advice you would tell people?
Take care of yourself. You are number one. And I know you may feel responsibility, certainly to that employer, to your families or whoever. If you are not taking care of yourself, you can't take care of other people. And so whether or not that's seeking help from a professional that is understanding what you're going through, whether or not it's menopause or these different menopausal symptoms, whether or not you take it on yourself to, okay, I've got to sleep better. How can I handle this and how can I do it? Is it my nutrition? Do I get personal time in for that? You've just got to take that time to say, I am number one here. I know my job's important. I know my family's important. My husband, my children, whatever is the deal. But you've got to think, how can I make this best for myself?
Dr. Doerr, thank you so much for joining me today. I think a lot of people listening will get a lot out of this.
Thank you so much. It's been a true honor and a pleasure.
Voices in Healthcare Finance is a production of the Healthcare Financial Management Association and written and hosted by me, Erica Grotto. Additional reporting is done by Nick Hutt, Sean Stack, and the HFMA editorial team. Sound editing is by Linda Chandler. Brad Dennison is the director of content. Our president and CEO is Ann Jordan.
Hippity hop hop.